Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Keith Gessen, my guest, is the author of All the Sad Young Literary Men. It's published by Viking. He is also one of the co-editors of a journal, N Plus One, and we'll be talking both about that novel and that journal today on Bookworm. Now, Keith, I am interested. Fitzgerald has a volume, All the Sad Young Men. But did you start there in building this, or did that title come later?
It came later, but I did have that. I did start with the idea of a group of guys sitting in a room, who having just come to New York and wondering what they're going to do and how they're going to conquer New York. And I feel like that is very much in the vein of Fitzgerald, being young and being in New York and just being amazed by New York.
But talk to me about the idea of conquest.
Well, it's more the idea of confusion. But these guys, you know, they get out of school, and in school, what they read about primarily was conquest, was winning, was greatness. And they had this encounter, this perpetual encounter with greatness. And then they have to get out into the world and see what that would mean even in contemporary America. And the answer to that is not obvious.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I'm a fan of your journal, N Plus One, but I'm a fan of greatness, but I don't think I'm a fan of winning. And I have, you know, like a severe inclination toward one rather than the other, because I think winning is mostly about not being great, but seeming great or being great at that moment. And I wonder about that.
Well, you know, the character in the book who's most concerned about this is Mark, and he has studied the Mensheviks, who are this socialist group that lost. They lost the revolution to the Bolsheviks. And, you know, and this is something that I've thought about a lot politically, where I'm temperamentally, I feel like a Menshevik. I think those guys were right. I think they were better guys. I would much rather spend my time with them. And yet, I also feel like politically, it's incumbent upon us to try to win. So that's the kind of the dialectic, right? You want to be the sort of person who would lose, who has the moral qualities of losing, and yet it's your responsibility not to lose, I think. We've lost a lot.
In this book, All the Sad Young Literary Men, the three sad young literary men are Jewish, one of them of Russian descent, one of them interested in Israel. All of them have gone to power schools, Princeton, Harvard, and are to some extent interested in issues of power, which are issues with which the magazine is concerned as well, readings of power. So it seems natural to me to want, as an older generation guy, to lecture you about power versus versus what? Aesthetics, that kind of thing. And it seems to me that it's at the heart of the book, yes?
Say more.
Well, the book is called All the Sad Young Literary Men. The Fitzgerald title is All the Sad Young Men. But these young men, however literary they may have wanted to be, they mostly are publishing articles about politics.
Mm-hmm.
They're not really literary men. Mm-hmm. They're men who have, to my mind, forsaken literature for the things that have replaced literature in New York.
Okay. That's true. So I've mistitled it.
not mistitled it. You see, I think that's part of the, at least the message to me of this book, that there are certain realms in which you can win and know you're winning as long as you're willing to give up on the realms where you can spend your whole life and never know whether you've won because the outcome is in doubt until later.
Well, that's true, and yet, you know, I feel like I don't know if I accept that account of literature. I partly do. I partly believe that these things are going to work themselves out in the future. That history will be the final judge of this of all of us. At the same time, we have. You know, and part of the reason we do the magazine is that we have an obligation to the present. We have an obligation to work this stuff out right now. We have an obligation to have these arguments right now and to put forward, you know, a vision of where literature ought to be going. And, you know, that's what we've been trying to do. So in a way, I don't accept the notion that we have to you know produce our work and then wait. The literary process, you know, it exists today. And I think if you look at literary history, you know, for every Kafka who was obscure and even Kafka was not that obscure, you know, not as obscure as we like to think. Certainly in Prague he was not obscure. You know, there is an Isaac Babel whose Red Cavalry was a major book and was greeted as such, and whose contemporaries knew exactly what it was.
Mm. No, but I'm talking about, and you know, I respect the argument. I'm not trying to say that I'm right. I'm just expressing a preference. Mm-hmm. The N+1 is often compared to the Partisan Review, and it's a useful example. Because most of the writers I think of with the Partisan Review wanted to be novelists as well as political commentators. But when you think of them, Dwight MacDonald, Mary McCarthy, who in fact reads the fiction?
Mm-hmm.
If anything, they read the essays, and I think those people were so busy in the battle of the now that their fiction, which even Susan Sontag took a back seat
mm-hmm.
for a very long time. And, you know, why? I'm not sure why. I think some of the fiction was indeed very good. I think that, you know, some of Mary McCarthy's stories, for instance, should still be being read, and they are as good as Fitzgerald's, and they fit in. They would be right next to this book. I think The Man in the Brooks Brothers Shirt, for instance. It's a terrific novella,
mm-hmm.
and about life as it's being lived now among the intellectual and business classes of New York, and making the decision of what kind of person you want to be and who and how you intend to make your mark. But I think that sometimes what happens is that the fray becomes so attractive and you're permanently newsworthy when commenting on the news
mm-hmm.
that the fiction kind of becomes, what do you say, of its time and disappears with its time.
I've thought about this a lot.
Obviously.
And, you know, well, part of the answer is, God, I wish there were people who were doing this instead of me. I wish someone else would run N+1. And I'm, you know, the day that when that day comes, I'll be a very happy person. The other, you know, and it's been with the reception of the book, it's been very much a double-edged sword where the book has gotten a great deal of attention for a first book. At the same time, a lot of that attention has been refracted through people's perceptions of N+1, of which I am one part, but certainly not the whole thing. You know, and Mark Greif did not write this book. I wrote this book. So it's been, you know, and I, in a way, I felt like it's been very distracting to readers of the book, and certainly to reviewers of the book, it's been extremely distracting. And, you know, and I made a pledge about a year ago that I would stop reviewing books, that I would stop writing about books. And I've not kept that pledge.
Now, my guest is Keith Gesson, and his book is All the Sad Young Literary Men. And I thought it would be a good idea, because it sets a context, to hear a little bit from the beginning, the prologue of All the Sad Young Literary Men. Keith?
Okay, this is the prologue. It's about Mark. In New York, they saved. They saved on orange juice, sliced bread. They saved on coffee, on magazines, movies, museum admission, Friday nights. Train fare, subway fare, their apartment out in Queens. It was a principle of sorts, and they stuck to it. Mark and Sasha lived that year on the 7 train, and when they got out in Queens, Mark would follow Sasha like a little boy as she checked the prices at the 2 Korean grocers and cross-checked them so they could save on fruits and vegetables and little Korean treats. They saved on clothes. It was 1998, and they were in love. They were done with college, with the Moscow of Sasha's childhood, with the American suburbs of Mark's, and yet they'd somehow escaped these things with their youth intact. To be poor in New York was humiliating a little, but to be young was divine. If you had had more money than they had that year, you'd simply have grown old faster. And so, with smiles on their faces, they saved. It was 1998, and they were angry. The U.S. had bombed a medicine factory in Sudan. The U.S. was inert on Kosovo, and then we started raining bombs. The Israelis continued to build settlements on the West Bank, endangering Oslo, and the Palestinians continued to arm. Contingency and irony, sure, said Tom in their kitchen. But have we forgotten solidarity? They hadn't. Mark and Sasha went to teach-ins, lectures, protests in Union Square. They attended free readings, second-run movies, $8 plays. The readings were miserable. The plays were horrible. The lectures were nearly empty. Some of the movies were good. Their friends came to visit from Manhattan, from Brooklyn, from farther away. Val's real name was Vasily, and he lived in Inwood. Nick wanted to be an art critic but worked for the moment at a bank with expensive art on its walls. Tom was a fiery radical of the far left. In college, he'd read Hegel's Phenomenology. In New York, he mostly read the political writings of Lomasky. Toby came to visit from Milwaukee and wandered around the city, his head craned up to see the faraway tops of the buildings. He was gifted with computers, but he wanted to write. Sam came from Boston and couldn't stop talking about Israel. He even had an Israeli girlfriend now. It was 1998. Mark and Sasha and their friends held down the following jobs: translator, gallery assistant, New York Times copy clerk, web temp, investment banker, temp, temp, temp.
You were listening to Keith Gesson reading from the prologue of All the Sad Young Literary Men. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Keith Gesson about his novel, All the Sad Young Literary Men. Now, to add, fuel to the fire, my professor, Lionel Abel, who was one of the Partisan Review theater people and good friends with the art critic Harold Rosenberg, said at the death of Rosenberg in a memory piece about him, he said, "In those days, we fought our battles with every weapon at our disposal. We were our weapons." And it really was a matter, and sometimes genuinely good. The battle that Harold Rosenberg fought was, in a sense, for abstract expressionism. And, you know, there are times when it is valuable to become your weapons. And I sense that N plus one was founded out of the sense that these weapons were necessary and that the journal would be a weapon. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
Yes. I mean, there was so much, and there still is so much wrong with our literary life. And, you know, we have these complaints about it. We have these, you know, people who complain that literature is dying, and people who have talked themselves into the fact that literature is dying, publishers who have talked themselves into this. And yet their solutions are their cures are worse than the disease. Mm-hmm. And we just saw this happen over and over and over again. And yet it seemed to us, you know, there were five of us. And we...
Who were you?
Okay. It was Mark Greif, Ben Kunkel, Marco Roth, and Chad Harbach. And then we met Allison Lorenzen, who became our managing editor. And, you know, we all came from very different places. Four of us had gone to the same school, and yet it wasn't like we were indoctrinated at this place. We had all come to very similar conclusions about what was wrong, you know, what was wrong with the war, what was wrong with American literature. And, you know, it didn't seem like we were very lonely. It seemed to us like there must be a lot of people like us out there. That is still debatable.
Now, in relation to the five of you, this book centers on three young men. Are they representative of you?
They're really just me. They all began as me, and then they took on kind of their own characteristics after making certain decisions and going to certain places. It's so obvious to me that they're me that I did not. For example, one of them is named Mark. And so some people have assumed that that's one of the editors of N plus one, and I should have thought of that. All the secondary characters are sort of based on real people. Some of them are in people that we know in New York, but not my co-editors.
And do you think about my sense is that in a sense these are three novellas. Mm-hmm. That have been intertwined. I'm not so sure that I love that they're intertwined, but I like that they're novellas. Did they tell me?
Oh, that's exactly right. But they developed. I mean, that's what it is. Yes, they sort of developed in a parallel way. I was finishing them all at the same time and developing them all at the same time. But yes, that's correct.
And they work out between them certain questions about involvement in life, in sex, and art. And they use different models, whether they're Babel or Hegel or, you know, ways of working out a dialectic between the things that demand one's attention in life. Yes? No?
You know, one of the characters goes through, he watches older men to see how he ought to, you know, he sort of tries them on in a way. So there's, you know, there's a literary critic named Morse Binkel in one of the stories. And There's his uncle, Misha, in another. So there's a kind of emulation of certain models. And then for the very historically minded Mark, there's Lenin. So there's a sort of perpetual trying to figure out how to exist in the world and, you know, having in one's mind all these models for how to exist in the world that have been successful or unsuccessful, and also discovering that ultimately those models are not going to be very much help. They will fill your mind and they will help pass the day, but in the end you're pretty much on your own out here.
One night there was a young critic and journalist named Patrick Giles who had seen me doing an event in Town Hall in New York and had gotten in touch with me, and he would call me a lot, and I guess he met you. Mm-hmm. And told me all about this a journal called N Plus One, and I read it, and I like it a lot. You know, it's one of the things I wouldn't miss an issue. I've said this before publicly. I think it's interesting and often funny, and you know, there are times when I want to be there on site in order to wrestle and tongue lash you guys, but nevertheless, you know, that's part of the fun. Mm-hmm. And this writer, who was very moving to me in many, many ways, because he had developed the idea that someone like him could not possibly make it in the world he aspired toward. He was by now in his 40s, and as we speak, you know, he's dead. He died. And I would say to him, no, those who have gone to Harvard go to Harvard and they use that, and those who are wonderful writers make sure other wonderful writers see their work and they use that. Why should your calling me in the middle of the night be any less of a doorway for you than anything else's? You know, stop it. Stop the feeling of jealousy and that others are excluding you, because this will only be a barrier to your work. And my sense is that a whole generation, that part of the reason of this war about celebrity and the web and whose photo was where and were you mentioned in the column, is because people have come to believe that you can't make it any other way, and any way that comes along that offers hope, like N Plus One, is going to be immediately so exclusionary that it's going to rule out everyone else. What do you think about those issues?
Well, in a way, I think I'm obviously, you know, I did go to Harvard, and I'm the beneficiary of the Soviet education system that educated my parents for free, so that they were highly educated, extremely well-read people, and they got to come to America as the beneficiary of Richard Perle's lobbying in Congress for the Jackson-Vanik Amendment. Well, and yet, you know, and if you're in New York, you do see that there are people who hang out at parties, and it's the same people, and they will get certain opportunities. That's absolutely the case. And if their parents are willing to pay for them through their 20s to subsidize them working as an assistant editor for $25,000 a year, then they will have certain advantages. And yet the cost of that, I think, is extremely high. The cost of hanging out, the cost of taking money from your parents, the cost of, you know, the, for lack of a nicer word, the emasculation of that is, that's a serious cost. And in the end, you know, you have to, this stuff is going to go out into the world. And the people out in the world, they don't know where you went to school. They don't, you know, when a book goes into the library, they take the book jacket off, and it no longer has your photo on it. It no longer, you know, has your little bio on it where you were published. And in the end, the stuff has to go out there and last. And you know, Patrick, he was a great writer. And you know, I wish he had, you know, he wrote in the first issue of N plus One, and we were talking about another piece that he was going to do. You know, and for us, it's a perpetual kind of battle to make sure that we don't become this thing.
How does someone who wants to find out more about N plus One? Is there a website? What's the?
There is a website. It's www.nplusonemag, all spelled out, nplusonemag.com.
And the book has been published by Viking. And, you see, I persist in thinking that this conversation that we've had, when it's been about the book and not, is part of the subject of the book.
That's correct.
That the yes. That the book is about these various opportunities, whether they exist or not, and the mistakes that people can make in the pursuit of false opportunity and false intellection. But is there, do you feel, by the end of this book, what's the real thing?
They all, each of the three guys works things out in his own way. And one of them fails to work things out. And one of them makes a political choice, and the other makes a personal choice. And for myself, you spend all this time wondering if you're going to become a great writer, or even any kind of writer, and you sometimes record this, the process of wondering about it, and then it turns out, well, that was what you wrote. I mean, that's what you produced. And this book is a record of that, for better and worse, certainly.
I've been speaking with Keith Gessen, author most recently of All the Sad Young Literary Men, published by Viking. Thank you, Keith, for joining me.
Thank you.
My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Associate producer is Alan Howard. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books can be funny, too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. In Keith Gessen's novel, All the Sad Young Literary Men, three well-schooled college grads come to New York. They want to experience the literary life and ultimately to succeed. What is success, and how does one achieve it? Is it all about opportunity? We explore the pursuit of opportunity, both real and imagined, when Gessen's my guest, next time on Bookworm.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.